Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Oh, gosh. Hello, 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 my wonderful audience. As always, I am so grateful to be talking with you today. I continue to meet people who listen to the show, get sustenance from the show, find the show stimulating and comforting, which is a good thing. It's a good thing. I don't aim at being comforting, but it seems to happen often when I talk with people, or maybe I aim more at comforting than I want to admit. I'm getting more soft and more spiritual as I grow older and wiser. And I am so grateful for the increasingly large audience that my work and all of our work in general is getting on the internet. And don't forget to go to Breggin.com and www.breggin.com, all the free services that are available. You can also get my books. You can get my blogs. Go to the archives of all these shows that I've done, going back years and years and years. Today, it could be one of the more interesting shows because it's going to be a show about therapy that is very different than perhaps any of you who are listening have ever heard about. And I'm going to just use that little teaser right now and then talk about a conversation I had today with my partner, not my familial partner, but my professional partner, Pam Poplar, the nutritionist. By the way, we're going to be doing our co-sponsored conference. Really, she does the conference, and I co-sponsor, and I come, and I get very involved in presenting and sharing and talking about psychology and psychiatry as well as nutrition. And that conference will be in Columbus, Ohio, and it's November 8th through the 10th this year. I haven't got it up on my website yet. so much has been going on, so many activities. You can follow some of them by signing up for my frequent alerts on the website. But I want to tell you about really a radical conversation that got more radical as it went along and more to the point and more principled and more honorable that Pam and I had. And it's very relevant to today's show about what it means to help people and who should be allowed to help people. I'm going to be doing a course through Pam's organization, and it's going to be called The Heart of Being Helpful. And it's going to be available in January. We'll have some introductions to the course at our big conference in November. And the theme of the course is the theme of my book, The Heart of Being Helpful. But it's going to be an extensive course aimed at enabling, helping, guiding, educating people to be helpful. Now, one of the tragedies of professionalism is that we now act as if helping people is a professional discipline to be licensed by the state, supported by great industries, divided up into academic disciplines, and so on and on, all to the end of greater government control, greater industrial control, and greater trade union-like professional control. American Psychiatric Association, American Psychological Association, they pretend to be something else, but they're just hard-nosed trade unions out to support themselves and the people who pay them. Sometimes they're members, but more often the greater pay comes from elsewhere, especially in my American Psychiatric Association. So suppose there were a course that didn't train you to be a psychotherapist, didn't train you to be a psychiatrist, didn't train you to be anything but helpful to people, especially helpful to people in terms of their relationships, their emotions, their happiness, their suffering. Suppose that's what you were going to be helpful with. Well, that's interesting, isn't it? Suppose that's what being helpful is about. Suppose it couldn't be monopolized. Suppose we issued a manifesto, as Pam suggests, that this is a manifesto that says people have choice about how and where they get their help, period. What about that? What about if we had a competing world in which Christian therapists did therapy, unlicensed? They just identified themselves as who they were and said, we're Christian therapists, we're associated with such and such organization. Look us up on the internet. And suppose we have therapists who are interested in your childhood and its effects, and they call themselves insight therapists or dynamic therapists, and they told you who they were trained by, what they believed, and they were on the internet. Would it be the Wild Wild West? No, it would be a marketplace. And that's a free marketplace. And that's just what the trade unions don't want that are called medical, that masquerade as medical and psychological groups. It's not what the government wants, certainly not what the pharmaceutical industry wants. Think about the most extreme situations we face in life. Let's say we're a family and one of our members becomes psychotic, starts hallucinating, has delusions, is very distressed, is aggressive. Suppose we assumed that we could help them. Suppose we assumed we could learn how to help them. And suppose we did a medium well job, or even a not so great job. Would it be anywhere near as bad as taking that loved one to a mental hospital to get neurotoxins that ruin their brains and teach them that they're helpless and hopeless and rob them of any faith in anything, in God, themselves, and their families, and their own abilities? So if we had a few bungling helpers out there, would they be anywhere near as dangerous as psychiatrists? I don't think so. I've never put it that way before. I'm getting older, and I'm getting more and more empowered to speak my mind. And my mind says that human beings have helped each other since time began. Today we're going to learn something about how they helped each other biblically, in the Bible, in the history of the Bible. I hope, I think we're going to hear something about that in about 2 minutes. So I'm here with a manifesto today. We need a marketplace of therapy. We need to judge therapists before we meet them by what they say about themselves, what they say they're offering, if they wish, by who has helped them learn to do therapy, perhaps by whatever education and licensures they have, but that is not very useful, and it's often inversely proportional to helpfulness. When I got through being a psychiatrist, even I had to de-indoctrinate to let go of my authoritarianism that I'd learned in all those years of medical and psychiatric training. So there's the manifesto. I'm going to be teaching a course starting in January. We'll be learning about it in more detail at the conference in November. And it's going to be the heart of being helpful. And it's going to be for anyone who wants to learn to be helpful to other people with their feelings, their emotions, their concerns with themselves, with their identity. And we're not going to use medical jargon, and we're not going to act like medical doctors. And it isn't intended for medical doctors. It's intended for everyone. Now, very appropriately today is my guest, Daniel Berger II. Daniel, are you there?
Yes, sir, I am. Yes, sir, I am.
We're with those sirs again, Daniel.
Sorry.
Daniel is a wonderful gentleman, and I'm kidding him about wanting to show so much respect for me. He apparently has a lot of respect for me, and we might talk about that. Well, I have a lot of respect for Daniel. Before I ever met Daniel, I knew someone that he knows, Ed Bulkley, B-U-L-K-L-E-Y. Ed is a minister, a Christian minister, who used to get in a lot of trouble because he would travel around to different churches, and among other things, he'd tell the people not to put their children on psychiatric drugs, that children who were undisciplined were a family problem and a spiritual problem and needed education and help and needed to be brought up properly. And he got in a lot of trouble for that. And then Ed invited me many years ago to address the International Association of Biblical Scholars, which you're going to be hearing about today. Over the recent years, I've lost touch with Ed, and I'm hoping this program will bring me back to him. He's in Denver. We haven't talked to each other in quite a while. Well, Dan Berger knows Ed. Dan is the founder of the Aletheia, if I'm pronouncing it correct, International Ministries, AIM. He writes and speaks around the country in various churches, organizations, he counsels, he talks to teachers. He's a pastor and a counselor, and he does have an MA in counseling psychology. We'll forgive that. And he's a doctor in pastoral theology, which is probably at least as appropriate as any other degree for trying to help people. He lives in Greenville, South Carolina. He's got four kids. It's going to be interesting to hear him talk from the viewpoint of a devout Christian who does what's called biblical counseling, which I'm quite familiar with, at least from attending a conference about it and speaking at it. His latest and probably his most important writing, The Insanity of Madness. And I'm going to let him start anywhere. He can either comment, though, on what I've been saying, or he can just leap into the Bible and talk about the concepts of madness and helping mad people. Daniel Berger, it's a very good day for you to be joining me on the show.
I am privileged and honored and really appreciate this opportunity.
Well, you're very welcome.
Well, thank you. And kind of to pick up where you left your manifesto, we many times call what we do, rather than counseling, we call it discipleship. I'm sorry?
Dan, I've only heard a few sounds. Can't hear you speaking. Have you got enough bars on your cell phone?
Yes. Am I back in?
Yes, you're back in.
Okay.
This always makes it exciting. Don't worry about it. Gets people's hearts beating a little bit. My palms sweat. Not really, actually. But are you back, my friend?
Yes, sir. So
yeah, I can hear you. So say a full sentence.
Okay. So we said to pick up where you left off on the manifesto, we specifically many times call what we do, instead of counseling, even though it is counseling in the popular sense, we call it discipleship, and I think that's true whether it's in a biblical setting or in a secular setting. I mean, those who study Sigmund Freud become Freudians, and they in turn use Freud's concepts in their counseling. So all of us essentially are making disciples when we counsel, and that's what we're doing, showing people from a biblical perspective how to interpret their mindsets, emotions, and behaviors versus the psychiatric mindset.
I love that. Freud said that that psychoanalysis was a secular moral endeavor. He wrote about that in a little biography that he once wrote. And he also wrote about it in something called The Question of Lay Analysis, where he said that you didn't have to be a doctor. You were basically a secular moralist. Boy, well, he forgot all of that.
Yeah, that same brochure, he says that his work and every psychotherapist is pastoral in nature. And I quote him in actually The Insanity of Madness. You know, and even prior to the whole concept of mental illness being invented, it was the church who had what is historically known as soul care. Now, of course, the psych has replaced a lot of people's vocabulary for soul, but it is not a concept that has gone away either. We and biblical counseling is growing tremendously, and people's lives are being positively changed. So it's just a matter of how we, you know, what disciple we're going to become and how we're going to make disciples and of who we're going to make disciples of.
Well, I think that's absolutely true. And even if we, well, in my case, for example, practically none of my clients have ever become reformers like me. So that's just not what my discipleship is about. I'm trying to help people take responsibility for their lives and learn to live as loving and principled a life as they can.
Right.
And if we succeed, that's what they do. And if you succeed, it's probably what your clients do. So it's not discipleship in that we have to form somebody's path in life necessarily, although perhaps more so for you, I'd be interesting to hear. For me, sure. It's leading and guiding and helping people find a strong, principled, loving life from which generally comes happiness if we're blessed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, go ahead. Well, I'm talking a lot already. Go ahead.
No. I enjoy listening to you. Even today, of course, our mental health system in the United States and really is spreading worldwide is Kreplinian, from Emil Kreplin, late 1800s. And if people believe in the brain dysfunction theory, the psychopharmacology we now call genetic theory, used to be eugenics theory, that is all Emil Kreplin's theory. So people who hold to those beliefs are Kreplinian, just as those who hold to Freud's theories are Freudian. But most people in the general population and many psychiatrists that I've talked to, they have no idea that our system is Kreplinian, let alone the horrific history. I know you've touched on that in toxic psychiatry as well. It has been a horrific display, and when it was introduced in the early 1960s, after Freudianism, ironically, was Jeffrey Lieberman in his book *Shrinks: The Untold Story of Psychiatry* actually talks about how you know Freudianism dominated the American Psychiatric Association, and now they look back on it, and he says they were delusional, and it's a real irony there. But in the 1960s, since it was introduced, things have gone downhill and not uphill as far as people recovering and our society improving in these ideas of mental health.
I'm with you 100%. I think that the effect of psychoanalysis on psychiatry, though, has been vastly exaggerated. But the leadership of psychiatry, based on a lot of grant money from foundations like Ford and Rockefeller, they really got the leaders to from among the psychoanalytic psychiatrists, but they were never more than about 10% of psychiatry. Psychiatry at its heart's always been Kreplinian, and I love what you're saying. I mean, I'm tempted to start giving up calling them biological psychiatrists and just call them Kreplinian.
That would
give them pause, because that's old.
Yes. Well, and of course, I think the vast majority of them, I guess I'm considered a theologian, but I'm one of those odd people that studies, I read things like molecular psychiatry. I'm sure there's a disorder for this, but I've talked to numerous psychiatrists that just look at me and go, I didn't even know there was a molecular psychiatry, a journal, medical journal. But I read a lot, and within the psychiatric literature, they do admit that they're what they call neocrepilinine. And, of course, that all goes back to when Bob Spitzer, between the DSM-2 and the DSM-3, took out homosexuality as a disorder and invented the now if you open the DSM, even under the definition of mental illness, which I address in The Insanity of Madness, they clearly point out that any distress or impairment that is ongoing is a mental illness. And, of course, they say it imprecisely and say this is a fluid idea, and we can't define it objectively. But, caffeine usage disorder as an example. If you feel like you need coffee in the morning, according to the DSM-5, you have a mental illness. And that type of impairment or distress is a creplinian construct, and really a neo-creplinian because of what Spitzer twisted. But you're right. These are disciples of Emil Kreplin, and unfortunately, our society, there are numerous people now taking on the identity of Kreplinianism, saying, I am bipolar, I am schizophrenic, even when you meet them. It really does get back to discipleship.
I love that concept. Tell us some about how does the Bible treat madness. I've actually had a classicist on, and I should have him back soon, talking sure. about the classical view of madness in the ancient Greek writings and plays. Talk about it in the Bible. I don't think I've ever had anyone on the air talk about it.
Sure. So I guess I should preface, and I cover all this in The Insanity of Madness, but all the most respected historians of madness, mental illness, psychiatry, like Edward Shorter, Roy Porter, Andrew Scull, for example, all of them say that our oldest understanding of madness begins in the Bible. And so even if you're going to approach this whole mental health issue from a Kreplinian standpoint or a Freudian standpoint, the Bible is essential to first understand this concept of madness. And in the Old Testament, there's several different usages, but what's fascinating is the most usages are when a prophet of God would go to, like, King Jehoah, for example, and would say in 2 Kings 9, 8 through 12, did you hear what this madman said? And it was not that the prophet was mad. It was actually that Jehovah was rejecting a truth. So it became a social control mechanism where you could label someone as mad if you didn't think that what they were advocating was true. You have other passages, like, for example, in Deuteronomy 28:33-34, and here is an example of Israel rejecting what God was saying. And he says to them, if you reject my truth, I will cause oppression and a crushing that will drive you mad. And it literally says in the Hebrew, it will drive you mad by the sights that your eyes see. So this is our first concept of what we call post-traumatic stress. And I will interject here too. I don't believe that post-traumatic stress is a disorder. I believe it's a normal reaction. Viktor Frankl, who is a Holocaust survivor as well as a psychiatrist, writes in one of his books that an abnormal response to an abnormal circumstance is normal. And I think that's beautiful. I just love the way he phrased that, painting a beautiful picture there. But yet in the Kreplinian model, we look at, for example, a little girl who goes through a rape or a molestation. And because she's struggling, we immediately call her disordered instead of the horrific events that happened to her. That's what's disordered. It's not meant to happen. And that she struggles with that both in a mental and emotional way is normal and should be expected. And so, that whole idea of what is normal goes back to this essential idea. But Scripture says that when we go through these traumatic experiences, they will produce what I call a crisis of faith in James 1. This is specifically what it says. We go through a crisis of faith. So the concept of madness in the Old Testament is a turning to deceit or identifying someone who is in deceit. And that's true with the New Testament as well. You've got Acts 26, for example, when King Festus says to Paul, he says, your much learning has driven you, and it's the Greek word manic, where we, you know, in the bipolar constructs, today we use mania to be the second part, of course, you know, depression in the unipolar and mania in the second part. And this is where the concept comes from. And he says, no, I am not manic. I have the truth. So he's reiterating here a very important concept in the Bible, and that is that madness is a turning to deceit. I'll give you one other illustration. The Jews said to Christ in John chapter 10, it said, either this man is demonic, you know, demon possessed under the influence of demonic activity, or he is manic. And the reason that those two are paired and correlated is because both have to do with deceit. And if you study, like the World Health Organization has done numerous studies on the concept, the construct of schizophrenia and psychosis in third world countries. And in India, for example, a lot of what we call psychosis is attributed to demonic influence. And they see people healed by what you were advocating at the very beginning, through relationships, not through drugs. And it's just a fascinating concept to go through and see all this goes back to a turning to deceit or beliefs in deceit, even in post-traumatic stress, if I can just touch on that again. When someone goes through a reality that their worldview, that their faith cannot handle, they still have to explain that. And so what has to happen is either they have to change their faith in order to explain what just happened, this horrific event, or they're going to deny reality. And once they deny reality and embrace deceit, it's a downward spiral. So that's why all the research shows there's a direct correlation between childhood trauma and bipolar, childhood trauma and schizophrenia, dissociative identity disorder, on it goes. This is our normal human reaction, not an abnormality, as we've been told within the Kreplinian model. And so that's a very kind of shotgun look at, you know, some of the things that I've uncovered. But, you know, the psychiatric concept of madness or mental illness is goes back to the same idea. So delusions, for example, is false fixed beliefs despite clear evidence and despite, you know, what society believes. And so the core of even delusions is false fixed beliefs, which is no different than what Scripture says. So now we're talking about beliefs. So, anyway, I'm doing the talking here.
You you started to fade again. We're talking with Daniel R. Berger, and I think we may have just lost him a little bit. Come back, Daniel, if you can.
Okay, I'm here.
Yeah, something is going on with just occasionally you disappear, but that was actually the first time since we started. One of my concerns about what you're saying is that if we equate madness or insanity with deceit, it stigmatizes people again. And what you're saying in part is that in the Bible it is a stigmatization. You're saying madness is seen as a turning away from the truth.
Right.
So I'm a little concerned about using such a pejorative word. It's interesting though. I mean, it's just so much is going through my head.
Maybe this will help a little bit. So in Genesis chapter 3, and of course, I believe all of our views go back to how we perceive normalcy in mankind. And for a Christian, we go back to Genesis chapter 3. And what happened with Adam and Eve is they were deceived, which Scripture says that causes all of us to be deceived. So it's not just a few people. And I'll give you a case in point. I like to say this when I speak, but if I knew your thoughts today, I probably wouldn't be talking to you just from this week, right? I mean, we are all messed up. And if I can use the word disordered rather, so there's not a stigmatization in Scripture. Jeremiah 17:9 says that the spiritual heart is deceitful above all things. And in the Hebrew, it actually says incurably sick. And that's the first metaphor that we have for what we call mental illness, but that whole context is metaphor. And it is a very interesting concept. If we take what is called degenerationism, and psychiatry is founded on this concept. Psychiatry looks at what went wrong. So you have these mass shooters, and we immediately go, we need to find out what went wrong versus a scripture understanding that it is wrong in all of us, not just some of us. And if we head down the path of deceit, if we allow deceit to be a part of who we are, it digresses us versus having our minds restored and thinking in truth. As scripture says, the truth sets us free. And of course, I'm a disciple of Christ, so I believe that Jesus is our standard of normalcy and that all of us need to have our minds restored to that truth. For every single person who disagrees with me, they still have to have a standard of what is normal and how people are progressing towards becoming what is often termed as self-actualization, if you would. Does that help at all?
Yeah, well, yes, it's all very interesting. I agree with so much of what you're saying in slightly different language, of course, and I... And I think that all human beings find life very hard, that we all struggle, yes. That it's a miracle when we have fulfilling times and happy times, and we want to, some of us, including me, feel very grateful to God for those times when things yes. go very well and we are living in a principled and loving way. Yes. I think that... I also think, and this is just sort of going around in different places, that you and I, for example, do share a profound belief in that there's a higher power, and for you it's a much more clearly defined religious higher power. For me, it's an idea about God that I can't quite explain. And we both believe in relationship, and we both believe in love.
Yes.
And I think in both of our experiences, the most effective, fulfilled, not necessarily happy. Happy is depends somewhat on circumstance. I mean, you're not going to be happy if your family's been wiped out. But the most successful and effective human beings are the people who build good relationships with other people, who develop a loving attitude toward others and toward life. And for most that I meet, they have an abiding belief in God, and they live with a sense of gratitude. Now, that doesn't mean, most of my audience may not have a belief in God. Haven't had a good demographics, but certainly a lot of people in the Reform movement don't have a strong right. sense of God in their lives.
Right.
But I think you and I, we share a lot in that area. And I think it makes sense to look at madness as kind of almost a norm for a human being, to the degree that that being has not imposed upon themselves or accepted a principled, loving, grateful view of life. How is that for an idea? It's a bit new for me.
Yeah, and that's why the door has been opened up to me to speak in so many different venues, because we have so accepted degenerationism and materialism in our culture, and those are probably big words for some of the listeners, but essentially the idea is that in evolutionary thinking, the idea of degenerationism, again, which psychiatry is founded on, is the concept that everything is good and progressing. If something goes wrong, then we try to figure out what went wrong. versus we're talking about in valid biological medicine, such as Alzheimer's, for example. There are specific biological markers and pathology. There's clear markers that we can trace back to what went wrong. When we're talking about the psyche or the soul, we're talking about something by nature invisible. So we don't have that ability to measure in a scientific way. And that's why when people tell me that things like psychosis are genetically caused, I go to delusions. Show me scientifically how you can trace a false belief to a genome or a series of genomes. It's impossible. That's not a scientific thing. And yet we've bought into this idea. And since you mentioned happiness, I think that's a great example. The three main components, even in the DSM-5, for what is called depression are hopelessness, deep and impairing sorrow, and false guilt, if you would, a guilt that isn't always true. So those are themes throughout Scripture, and I believe that they're all of our condition. I believe every single person in this world is actually depressed, and what happens is we set up hopes that, as Proverbs says, when hope is deferred, when it's exposed to be a false hope, it actually makes the spiritual heart, the soul, sick. And so we go into a worse state of hopelessness when we become disappointed. And if we're honest, all of us we make decisions on who we marry and where we move to and what we go eat based on the desire to be happy. Even in our founding fathers said that in the Constitution that we have the right to pursue happiness. That's really interesting that our founding fathers understood that we don't have happiness. We're on a pursuit for it. Every single person is. And so when people become what we call depressed, we tend to look at them as abnormal versus all of us are in this same category biblically. We're all in a need for hope. We're all in a need to find joy. We're all in a need to have our guilt remedied. And that's why I think the message of Christ is not just important. It's helping people tremendously. When they start realizing they're not stigmatized and abnormal, that we're all in this together, there's a unity there that we've been talking about. But there's also a hope that what Christ did, he dealt with all of guilt. Almost all the psychiatric constructs, the major constructs of madness, now called mental illness, the serious mental illnesses, if you would, I put that in quotes, all of them include guilt. And it's a really fascinating thing that even in the American Psychiatric Association understands that guilt is one of the key components that people are struggling with. I really believe that anxiety is another one. I don't know a single person that's not anxious, and if they're not, it's because they're not thinking about reality. You know, anxiety is our true nature. America right now is in a crisis, and if we are all struggling with various anxiety in our heart, and of course everyone has to deal with those differently, but we have those. And we've so accepted degenerationism that we're missing who we really are as people.
Well, I think that this basic theme is incredibly important. People who have listened to me talk know that I certainly feel that the fundamental message of Christ, which is to love God and love one another,
right,
is a fundamental to healthy living for many, many, many people. I'm not a Christian in that I cannot find that I have faith in the resurrection and in other aspects of Christianity. Mm-hmm. But my thinking does not seem to vary very much outside of that from people who are devout Christians. And who actually believe in the importance of responsible relationship and love and service to the community and a belief in God or something higher and greater than human beings. And I love your emphasis on this concept of that psychiatry and we would say psychology and acts as if human beings are in their natural state happy, or human beings in their natural state are satisfied, when in fact
Correct.
Human beings in their natural state are always in pursuit
That's
of
right.
happiness,
That's
of
exactly
security,
right.
of all sorts of things. That certainly is my life, my wife's life, my wonderful mother-in-law Jean, who's been living with us
Yeah.
now for several months, and we pursue, and
Yes.
even if we're pursuing how to live our old age gracefully and lovingly,
Right.
or how to get through adolescence and the inherent madness of it.
Yes.
And I just think it really will help people who are trying to help other people understand that we all are in pursuit, that we all struggle, the human beings, as I'm fond of saying, human nature leaves much to be desired. If
Yes.
we are the product of purely evolution, it's a very flawed process indeed. And we have a lot of work to do
Well, we do, and
to
I mean
bring
this
ourselves
is,
to a proper status.
yeah.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to add to that essentially psychiatry is a new moral system. It's telling people how they need to view normalcy as well as mindsets, emotions, and behavior. They haven't invented anything new. And you were talking about getting licensure or not. I had the opportunity. One of my good friends, Dr. Hugh Clark, who's a neurosurgeon, highly regarded. And he was pushing me to go back and go to med school. And as I have studied this, I mean, inside and out, this whole idea, both the philosophy, the history, as well as the practical nature of what we call mental illness or madness, I've come to realize that, for example, ADHD as an example, there's 18 behaviors. You need no knowledge of biology, no medical degree at all. All you have to do is interpret behavior according to someone's system, specifically the DSM-5 in this case, in order to diagnose. And that's why teachers are the ones actually diagnosing. There's no biology here. There's no need for medical training in order to do this. So if this is all a matter of interpreting behavior, and the same is true with psychosis, right? And by the way, I'll add this, as I think it's important. We can't have false fixed beliefs unless there's true beliefs. And we've missed this in our whole idea of delusions because of the American Psychiatric Association. I think Dr. Alan Francis, who chaired the DSM-4, really does a good job of pointing out that utilitarianism guides the American Psychiatric Association. And that is that the majority, or at least those with the most power, determine what is normal and what is abnormal. And we have completely missed that. Truth is essential to this whole equation. And of course they say that truth is relative, it's not objective, but you cannot have falsehood if there's no objective truth. And yet we have, I don't know exactly how many. I think there's eight or so delusions, from somatic delusions to grandiose delusions, et cetera. And by the way, somatic delusions are one of my favorite because here's a person that goes to the doctor, right? They believe that they have a physical ailment. There's no biological markers and there's no pathology. So they're diagnosed with an alleged disorder or disease that has no pathology and no biological markers. it's almost comical, but yet this is, this is that mentality of anything that cannot be explained with an evolutionary theory is put over because distress and impairment cannot be viewed as normal and within this concept. And, I think we do a disservice to people who are genuinely suffering and struggling with anxiety, struggling with hopelessness by further stigmatizing them and saying something's really wrong with you. Of course, the self-fulfilling prophecy kicks in. And creates a delusion, essentially. It's just saddening to me where we have come in our society where people who need help are just being set aside, numbed and tranquilized, sedated, however you want to call it, and being told they're abnormal versus, hey, we're all messed up. Let's do this together.
Yeah. I mean, it really is. It gets us to the point of saying that the biochemical imbalance is a crowd delusion, in a sense.
It is. It is.
Let me, with that brilliant insight, let me redirect you, because we only have, we've really raced through this time. We have only about maybe 12 minutes left. And I want to look at what is, perhaps from my audience's viewpoint, going to be the most radical idea, which is the kind of therapy that is called biblical therapy. And I want to introduce it by saying that when I was invited to speak a number of years ago, and I hope to be invited again soon, to the International Association of Biblical Counselors, what I found out is that, and then I want you to take over and tell the truth about it rather than my outside view, that it basically involved listening in a caring way to a person's issues and then finding a biblical passage and a biblical understanding that was appropriate to it. Now, I also know from hearing you today that you have a very good understanding of a place in trauma, of trauma in life. So I think it would be interesting for you to address if there is such an importance of trauma, as we both acknowledge, you know, how does that fit? Is it okay to simply ignore the origins of certain kinds of despair and overwhelm? And and I want to repeat the anecdote I told you, that when I spoke at the conference, it was mostly a critique of biological psychiatry and how it was a materialistic religion in a deep sense, and how people should have faith in their own religion and develop counseling methods consistent with their own religious viewpoints.
Sure.
But that I just wanted to mention that that I believe that the harm that and problems we undergo through our childhood universally often makes us afraid to love, which is, I think, the most important human experience. And that maybe some of their clients or parishioners who had trouble loving God or loving Jesus might be helped by coming to understand some of the trauma, maybe even religious trauma they had at the hands of a I don't think I said this, at the hands of a minister, which made them so distrustful of God later on. I see that in my practice a lot.
Yes.
So I just wanted to give all that as a background and let you address that for about 10 minutes or so on the issues of biblical counseling, because this is very radical by my standards and the standards of probably everybody in the audience, just about, unless some folks from your group are tuned in. So talk about that, because I have a deep respect for you and what you think, and I want to hear you talk about that.
Well, I appreciate this opportunity, and I will also say this. There are a lot of people who go to church, who are churched, who this is a radical concept too, because the Kreplinian belief system is so prevalent in our society, and so this is shocking to not just those who may have you know, rejected that there's a God, or at least said, I don't believe that the Bible is the truth. This is it's not a new concept. I believe it's been here, you know, since the beginning of time. But let me use psychosis as an example, because this seems to be one of the most, you know, it's almost a monster in itself. People are afraid they don't know what it is, et cetera. But if we tear apart, you know, set aside catatonia, because I believe catatonia is an effect of thinking. Psalm 77 actually mentions specifically when King Asaph was struggling with this crushed spirit. And by the way, that's what Scripture calls hopelessness, is a crushed spirit. So it talks extensively about the hopeless condition from Genesis chapter 3 all the way to Revelation chapter 1 as it being normal. And So setting aside catatonia and looking at delusions and hallucinations. First of all, delusions, again, by definition, I think it's important to reiterate, are false fixed beliefs. Of course, they've added the social axiom and all the other articles there on the end. But at its core, a delusion is someone who is believing falsely. And I think this is what we've missed in our society is in order to help someone who has false beliefs, they must accept true beliefs. And that it's so simple that I think we've overlooked it because we bought into the medical idea. And this goes, you know, neuroscientist Sam Harris in his book, The End of Faith, is kind of humorous because he tries to attack the whole concept of faith being essential to this. He buys into the brain dysfunction theory and says that the brain produces faith, but he destroys his whole argument in the opening paragraph by saying that faith determines our behaviors, our emotions, our thoughts, our cognition. He blows away his whole argument in the first chapter there. And we are talking specifically about with delusions, false fixed beliefs. And this is why changing someone's faith is essential. Now, let me say this. I can't change anyone's faith, and I don't try to do that. So if someone comes to me for help, I'm going to present truth to them, but I cannot make anyone believe or not believe. So I'll have people that come to me. I'm helping several people right now that one of them was diagnosed with schizoaffective disorder. The other one originally had ADHD and then was diagnosed with bipolar, and probably because of the stimulants they were on, et cetera. And they have fully, quote unquote, recovered after years of being labeled as this. I have other people that it's a gradual process. It's not a magic bullet. And I will say this as well. Our society is looking for a quick fix. But Scripture actually talks, we call it in theological terms, we call it sanctification. It's having our minds restored to that of what Christ has, which is simply to love God and to love others, to be truthful and to come into truth. And that's why the truth sets us free. So I can't make anyone, put aside their falsehood. All I can do is present truth to them. And I'm seeing many people come to truth and have victory over their psychosis because they're simply saying, and really kind of the progress, just to give you a clear picture here, many times what happens is as they begin to take control of their thoughts and not let this deceit creep in, they begin to go from being psychotic and not aware of it to being psychotic and understanding that they're being deceived, to being deceived but in a pleasant way, to not being deceived at all. So there's a progress here, and this is the biblical pattern for all of us. I'm still coming out of deceit. I'm growing. I'm becoming more Christ-like. I'm messed up. I need God daily. So this is the biblical concept. For depression, for example, one of the things that I love to do is to take them through in Scripture. I mean, Christ himself was known as the man of sorrows in Isaiah 53. He was well acquainted with grief, and then Scripture says that he was rejected of men. And the vast majority of cases of depression that I encounter are people who either lost a relationship or have been rejected in a relationship. And it's so significant that their hope was in that person. And so when that hope was deferred, it makes the heart sick. But when they start seeing that even Jesus...
Let me interrupt for a sec, because
yes.
I think what you're saying is very, very important. But I think there will some of the people, and I am very interested to know, do you say to people, along with finding the appropriate biblical, appropriate scripture, do you say to people the kinds of things you're saying here, that you had a loss,
absolutely, yeah.
All right. So you're not just doing the scriptures. You're also talking, at least, about therapeutic principles that we would call, you know, therapeutic principles.
Well, yeah. So, for example, what is known as cognitive behavioral therapy, I believe, is a biblical concept long before, you know, psychologists claimed it for themselves. Now we have scientific studies like psychoneuroimmunology and epigenetics, which are essentially showing the same thing. But in scripture, for example, in Proverbs chapter 4, we probably don't have time to go into this, but simply to say...
Let me shorten it, because I want to ask... when you're actually conversing with a person, just so we can get an idea, you're sitting there and that other person's sitting there, you have a Bible and you're going to be quoting from it at times. But at other times, will you be talking with them about the losses they've had?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay.
This is a real
good. That's different than some other people who practice. Am I right about that?
Absolutely. This is relational. And you started out with that, and I think this, you know, the Bible, again, the key laws of all the laws hang on is to love God and love others. So we're in a relationship with these people. We're broken people. We're not coming to them as we've got it all together. We're coming to them, hey, let's do this together. And that's why we find a church body to be so important. Of course, there's some really bad churches out there, you know, horrific you know, experiences that some people have gone through.
Yeah, let me ask again, Daniel. Is there any debate within biblical therapists about whether to do anything other than identify scriptural portions and whether or not to bring in, well, you've been through this trauma, obviously you would lose faith, as you would say. It's a normal process. You get traumatized, you lose faith. That's a normal process to be helped through. Is there any discussion among the group that you're in, and that's meeting, I guess, in August in Buffalo? That is meeting in August in Buffalo. Is there any discussion of these distinctions? That interests me a lot because, of course, I do a combination. I don't read from the scriptures, but I sometimes do quote, God says, you know, we should just love one another and love God.
Yeah, we believe that what we call sufficiency. So everything that we've been talking about from top to bottom, when we call it mental illness, obviously Alzheimer's disease is a neurodegenerative disease. It has valid pathology, et cetera. There's autism, dementia, things like that should not be in the DSM-5 as a mental illness. But when we're talking about the invisible, as Lieberman says, the invisible problems of the soul, those issues are all covered. I mean, from top to bottom, every single detail is in Scripture. And that's what we're doing is showing them, okay, Christ has the answer to things. He not only fully develops and addresses these things, he actually helps you and remedies you through them. But there is a debate, you know, people trying to wed Kreplinianism in the Bible.
Well, that I certainly hope doesn't happen. Daniel R. Berger II, thank you immensely being on the show. It's been very, very interesting. Folks, open your eyes to all there is out there. It's a big universe of loving human beings. Thank you again, Daniel.
Thank you, sir.